Good morning. Welcome, listeners. We were just talking about you. It's 14 minutes past 9 o'clock. It's good to have you here on this Tuesday morning, and we are delighted. It took us a few minutes to get everybody in. We'll tell you about that in just a second. We've got a huge panel. We've got a wonderful panel today, and we'll get started in record time. Let me just remind you two things. One, if you'd like to get in on the conversation, panel@wamc.org. Keep your letters short, keep them sweet, which is another way of saying be nice, and we'll get to your letters, hopefully. Also, a programming note, Governor Andrew Cuomo will be on with Alan at 10:30 this morning, so stay tuned for that. That'll be coming up. And we, as I mentioned, have a fantastic panel, so let me introduce the whole group to you. Mike Spain is to my immediate left on the radio. He is... in many ways. He is a former associate editor at the Times Union in Albany and or Colony or wherever that building is, and it's a great pleasure to have Mike
Thank
on
you.
The program. Good morning. Libby Post is here. Libby is a political consultant, and she joins us. Good morning, Libby.
Good morning, Joe.
Great to have you here.
Thank you.
Fran Berman is back with us.
Yay.
We are thrilled. We always love when Fran is here. The Edward Hamilton Distinguished Professor of Computer Science at RPI. Good morning.
Good morning, and happy International Women's Month to everyone.
And to you. Thank you very much. The International Women's Day was on Friday of last week, so we have the whole month to celebrate as well. So good stuff there. J.P. Miller is with us. He is the Empire Reports guy. He is the creator. He is the founder. He is the man behind it. And we are thrilled to have you with us.
Thank you for having me. Happy International Women's Month.
Thank you, J.P. Good to see you. Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan.
Hi.
How are you?
Just ducky.
Excellent.
I just, in the middle of the night, I got out of bed at 7, but in the middle of the night, all of a sudden it occurred to me to look at my email, which I do sometime, and there was this very long
A very long
back and forth as to when the governor could come on, because he was on his way to Buffalo, see? So we've already done that. We've already done that interview, which you will hear at 10:30.
That's right. So it is.
Any hints, highlights, or, you know, teasers?
Any teasers, that's right. We want to tease.
Yeah, well, you know, he said, among other things, that if we don't get that tunnel built between, you know, New Jersey and Manhattan, that what can happen is you could have a major disaster. I mean, we knew that. He said, talked about collapse. There's also a very interesting story, which maybe JP will know more about than I do, but basically that the Democrats under Speaker Hastie in the state legislature were always for campaign finance reform. In other words, giving money to people who were running, and they could raise a certain amount, and then there would be a multiplier about that. But guess what? Now that they're in charge of the legislature in both houses, they're against it. Why? It's so clear, because now they have to live with the results, and they got here under the old system. It's despicable hypocrisy.
Did you want to add anything?
Yeah. Well, the governor, during his press conference yesterday, made some good points that people, you know, people can run on multiple lines. How is it going to be funded? Where is the money going to come from? But it is, it would be something that would challenge the power of incumbents. And incumbents don't like things that will challenge their power. And so now all of a sudden they're against campaign finance reform.
Bet.
So that interview coming up at 10:30 this morning, they talk about all kinds of things, marijuana legislation in danger, campaign finance reform, as Alan mentioned, Democrats and the Jews. We'll talk about they'll talk about that as well. The New York impacts from the president's budget. So a lot going on, and that interview to run at 11:30 this morning.
No, 10:30.
10:30 this morning.
Well, it would be 11:30 if we're on that other.
That's right.
Time
yeah, if we didn't. Yeah, spring. Yeah, whatever.
Unnecessary time.
10:30 this morning. Okay. Good morning. Let me get to the stories at large here, and we start with the Trump budget, and talk about the governor seeking $4.7 trillion in budget with domestic cuts, $8.6 billion in wall funding. That is the headline. The plan would dramatically expand spending on programs and initiatives popular with Republicans, such as $750 billion in new defense spending. The wall, of course, at the same time, it would slash spending on Medicaid, food stamps, environmental protections, and other programs that Democratic presidential candidates vowed to preserve and expand. The budget proposal ran into an immediate buzzsaw on Capitol Hill, where many Democrats flatly rejected it, and even some Republicans sought to distance themselves from key details. Top White House officials acknowledged that lawmakers routinely dismiss these budget proposals, but they signaled a willingness on Monday to fight harder this year than they have in the past. I believe, they print these things. And the title of this is A Budget for a Better America, mm-hmm. Promises Kept, Taxpayers First. There you go.
Well, it's not promises kept. He promised during the campaign that he would protect Medicare. This one would cut Medicare spending by $845 billion over the next 10 years. He promised not to run up a deficit, and this budget includes a $1 trillion deficit every year for the next couple of years. And add that to the current deficit, and that's a lot of money. We're spending more paying interest than we are on Medicaid, mm-hmm. which is the other program that's being attacked by this. And yet the price of the wall has gone from $5.5 billion up to $8.5 billion. I guess inflation. I don't know.
Give them a little something extra to play with.
Right.
Mike, it really is something. But I think probably you may be wrong in that he kept his promises. He kept his promises to himself and his family. It's just the other people he didn't
Those other promises.
Right. The public promises were not kept. The private ones were.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not taxpayers first when you're cutting food stamps and environmental protections and the Department of Education. You know, it's just not taxpayers first. It's public good in this country has really suffered under Trump. And, it's time for us to be thinking about getting it back.
Yeah, what I was most disappointed with in the New York Times article that outlined this was the 5% growth in defense spending. We're spending hundreds of billions of dollars every year on defense, more than we were now than when we had 50,000 troops over in Iraq, when we don't have 50,000 troops in Iraq now. So, and the other thing that was mentioned is that Trump's budget right now is not irrelevant, but it is not what Congress is going to put together. What Congress is going to put together is going to be led by Speaker Pelosi and Senate Leader McConnell, and what Trump's priorities are in this budget is not what will end up getting signed eventually. And the other thing that was mentioned yesterday is that Schumer and Pelosi both said that there is the possibility for another shutdown with Trump's proposal as it stands.
Mm-hmm. It's just unthinkable that the guy, because of his personal politics, would shut down the government again. And that's where your point about McConnell comes into play. Because McConnell has to protect his people, many of whom are going to be in very bad, tough spots when it comes to the senatorial elections in 2020. And people will have long memories on this thing. So McConnell we think that the reason that the president ended up succumbing on the earlier shutdown was because of McConnell, because he went and said he couldn't hold back his people. Now, if that happens again, we might really finally see some of the Republicans in the United States Senate taking a different look at this president.
But that's a really discouraging part, because the budget, at least from Trump's side, and I think JP is right, I mean, this is just sort of the first volley in a, pretty long volleying back and forth. But, it's kind of discouraging that the budget is about the election rather than about the country.
Sure.
What do we need as a country? What kinds of things are important? What do we need to repair? What do we need to build up? What do we need to initiate? And I don't see any of that. I see all of this about, how can I position myself for my constituency in
my
election.
States that voted for me.
Yeah.
The time of governing, that window is getting shorter and shorter and shorter because we're in a constant campaign mode. And Trump never governed at all. He just started running for re-election the day after the inauguration. And so everything he does is targeted at that. And you know, if McConnell wants to maintain some kind of Republican control in the Senate, he's got to do something for the constituents. I mean, some of his people represent some of the poorest states in the country, and they're going to get hit by this tax cut. They're going to get hit by Medicare and Medicaid cuts, food stamps cuts. I mean, I think Trump thinks only people of color get food stamps. And so who cares if they don't eat? I mean, that's his thinking, and that's Stephen Miller's thinking. And so, sure, we'll cut all that money, but it's really the constituents of some of these marginal Senate Republicans that are the ones that are being hurt.
You know, if you look at the list of cuts, he's going to cut the Environmental Protection Agency 31%, the State Department and U.S. Foreign Aid 24%, the Department of Transportation 19%. Agriculture, Interior, Education, Energy, and Labor, they're all facing cuts in this budget. Yeah, you're right, JP. This is not going to be the budget that gets passed. It's a political document that affirms his own political point of view, and there'll be lots of changes to it before it ever gets through the Congress. Even the Republicans won't approve a lot of this. But it does, for him, for Trump, it does underscore where his priorities are, and that is defense 5%, Homeland Security 7% growth, a Veterans Affairs. That's an interesting one. That would get the biggest hike, 8% hike. And, you know, that's going to be hard for people to disagree with.
Except he wants to privatize all the VAs and all the veteran services.
Yeah, what's that money go for? Yeah.
Well, the method that it's spent is going to be heavily debated, right. But people certainly agree that we have to do more for the veterans.
You know, I'm thinking that let there be one really major catastrophe, and believe me, I don't want to see that happen. But let's just assume that the governor who said, you know, that these tunnels were facing a disaster and you know who goes through those tunnels. He points out it's Amtrak. Mm-hmm. And you can imagine if there's an Amtrak train in one of those tunnels and the Hudson River comes crushing in, this president is going to be open to an awful lot of blame.
Well, you know, yesterday somebody took me to task for making a connection between Trump and NTSB and the plane crash. The Ethiopian, and they said, well, you can't blame him for that. Well, there's how much of a cut is there to the transportation budget? And that's where NTSB is. It'd be interesting if we could drill down to see how much they're cutting NTSB, you know, because he doesn't care about people. He cares about a small group that's going to make a lot of money off of this budget, and that's it.
So, as Mike points out, as you all pointed out, what we end up with is not what we see in this document, but what are the political wranglings? You can only assume it's already started that the Democratic candidates for president, those who have officially announced, are having a field day with it.
Well, you know, to me, I think this primary season is over already. Nobody agrees with me, but I do. I think in the end, it's going to be Biden versus Bernie. There's a good deal of and the polls are already showing that, you know, and Biden isn't even into it yet. He's giving a speech today, but he's not going to announce, apparently. Why should he? He's leading in the polls, right. You know, anyway. So I think the other guys are going to be starting to drop out like flies.
Brown
dropped out.
Yeah, that's right. Sherrod Brown. Yeah.
And I was particularly interested in Gillibrand. You know, you put yourself up there as a potential presidential candidate, and she has been pretty much assiduously a Me Too candidate.
That's right.
And now,
her too.
They who live by the sword also die by it. She did not give a chance to Al Franken to clear himself. She just demanded he quit right away, and he did, for far less than we are hearing with some of these other people. So now Gillibrand faces a real problem here.
You're talking about the Politico story on Monday that talked to a former staffer who complains that she alleged one of the other staffers was sexually harassing her, and that it was not timely investigated, and then she left the staff and was disgruntled. And Gillibrand says it was fully investigated and it didn't amount to a case of sexual harassment.
And then they fired the guy.
But they fired him, right? yeah. since then.
So in other words, first it was we fully investigated, and then it was all of a sudden the guy is off the cliff, which was fascinating.
Yeah, the optics of it aren't good. She's having trouble getting the campaign, getting traction in the campaign.
Oh yeah, she doesn't show
I mean, it's remarkably similar to the the lack of traction that George Pataki got in the last campaign when he was a primary candidate. He was just hardly mentioned and didn't get a lot of national press. It doesn't mean they're not neither of them was had good things to offer, but. It's just very difficult when there's, more than 10 people in the race.
I don't know, Mike. All I know is you say almost dismissively, and I don't ever want to, do anything but tell you how wonderful you are. But when you say almost dismissively, that was that Politico story or whatever. But it turns out on the Gillibrand case, and this is why it's so important to be the front page of your old newspaper and virtually every other newspaper.
Oh, big story.
It's a big story.
It's a major story. She is the Me Too candidate.
Right.
Yeah. Well, and she's also a New York senator.
And she is.
And by the way, and another story that came out recently.
We have 10 seconds, but go ahead.
Okay, was that no New York politicians are supporting her.
That's a big deal. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome your letters. panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. And we'll continue with Alan and JP, Fran, Libby, and Mike right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable on this Tuesday, the 12th of March. We have Mike Spain, Libby Post, Fran Berman, J.P. Miller, and Alan Chartok with a fistful of letters. He'll start us off.
Fistful indeed. Not. Eve says, is it always anti-Semitic? Uh-oh, here comes the letter. Hello, esteemed panel.
Hello.
Can you give an example of how a person might object to Israeli politics and the U.S. involvement therein without being accused of being anti-Semitic? Okay, I'll do it right now. Me! I don't like their politics. I don't like what Netanyahu is doing, and I'm not anti-Semitic. Is that enough for you or not? Some of us, not being heavily exposed to anti-Semitism, might find that many of the offensive terms are like landmines unknown till they explode on you. When are we going to stop being so hair trigger? Soon no one will be able to talk about anything for fear of offending someone somewhere about something. I'm so sorry. When somebody says American Jews are, basically have more allegiance to Israel than they do to this country, I find that to be anti-Semitic. So sorry. But there you go, Eve. Thank you. And Barbara says, cuts, promises kept, ? The promise was not to cut Medicare, Medicaid, or Social Security. Taxpayers first, ? People on these programs are and have been taxpayers. March is Brain Injury Awareness Month. Thousands of disabled rely on Medicaid and SSDI in order to remain in their communities and not be forced into institutions, not to mention the elderly who have worked and paid taxes for all their lives and now live balancing the little they receive in benefits with the rising cost of medicine and hospital costs. I am, says Barbara, outraged. And Joel says, regular writer Joel says, budget. Good morning. The title of the Trump budget document is incomplete. The first title should be Fleece Taxpayers First, Last, and Always. The 1% will not be fleeced. They don't pay taxes. And that's Joel from Blooming Grove. And Frederica, Trump budget. I am very alarmed by an article by Sarah Cliff of Vox outlining the health care portion that again tries to eliminate protections for pre-existing conditions, among other problems. What about children with diseases such as type 1 diabetes that will extend to adulthood and require insulin to survive? This whole concept, including legalizing, quote, junk policies, is frightening. Thank goodness New York seems to be out in front on some of these issues, and there is from Frederica. And that's what more?
Yeah, added some more.
Oh, thank you, Joe. And Roger says, seems to me that Trump's budget hands a huge cudgel to the Democrats, allowing them to criticize 45 during the campaign that he's gone back on basic promises. Lack of potential awareness on the part of Trump's staff And that's Roger from Pleasant Valley, where I believe everybody smiles. But the question for all of you guys is, well, who is carrying the mail for the Democrats to counter the Trump propaganda 101 messages that he does? I don't like it, and I don't like saying this, but he does well for his base. So who is it? Is it Chuck Schumer? Who is it who is – no, and Fran is saying
– I'm sorry, Fran's I was nodding.
Fran's
I don't
got
think
a
you
frown
can all
on her
that.
Face and saying no. Who is it? Who's doing that?
Well, if you were to pick one, the best messenger the Democrats have right now, it's freshman Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and hopefully they will put her out to combat the message. I mean, she's the best messenger they have. Down in Texas this weekend, she drew a bigger crowd than Bernie Sanders, who is a big crowd guy.
Yeah, well, there's a downside to her also. Some of her so-called progressivism may float into what many Americans consider to be unacceptable. I was a big fan in the beginning. I'm not so much anymore. I think her support of Omar on the Jewish issue and what and the anti-Semitic tropes and stuff, that bothered me a little. Now, she had been accused of that herself, and she went to a synagogue, and she acquitted herself very well by talking about how that there were Jews in her family lineage. But I think she's got to be very careful.
I disagree. I am a fan. I think she's refreshing. I think she's authentic. I think she's imperfect. And I think she's
Did you say imperfect?
Imperfect, yeah. And I think she's doing her best to really represent her constituency and her own beliefs.
Well, then we don't agree. I mean, we do agree.
Yeah.
Because I think she's imperfect also.
I think she's, what, she's 28, 29 years old?
Yeah.
She has enormous potential, and if she doesn't blow it, she mm-hmm. has an enormous future in the Democratic Party. But she could burn out early and disappear if she is not careful.
Well, there's a major article in one of the big magazines. It wasn't The Atlantic. It was another one. I was reading it in the middle of the night last night, in which they got to sit down with her in her kitchen table in Parkchester. She said, among other things, that she really had no idea what this was going to be all about. And in fact, one day, one person came to a press conference. She offered one journalist. And the next day, she was being whisked. After she won the primary, she was being whisked into a car, a Cadillac Esplanade, to be on Morning Joe. And sure, that's gotta really get to somebody's brain when you go through something like that.
But I think it must be that way for everyone. You know, you're in a situation you've never been before, and you jump in the deep end and you learn how to swim.
Never been that way for me.
That's good to know,
Alan. It'll be interesting to see if she can resist the seduction of power.
Good point.
You know, that's really it. I mean, and I think I said this yesterday.
What do you mean?
Well, you know, when Stanley Fink and
by the way, Mel Miller died.
I know.
Mel Miller, old speaker.
He was a good guy.
Great assembly speaker.
Yeah.
What'd you say, Mike?
A great assembly speaker from the late 90s. Short-lived. Late 80s, early 90s.
But, when Stanley Fink came in, when Shelley Silver came in, they came in as reformers. And then they gained the power. They were seduced by the power, and they became very, very, very powerful and squashed other people who wanted to come up and be reformers. So it's the seduction of power, and we'll see how well she can balance having power and maintaining the politics that she has. It's not an easy thing. People like power. People are seduced by power. It's one of the biggest aphrodisiacs there is in politics. And, well, just it'll be a waiting game. It's the same goes for all of them. You know, she was at South by Southwest this past weekend.
And
big
JP
crowds, right?
Yeah.
You know, so, and, you know, JP, the thing about South by Southwest is that not everybody there is from Texas. So, you know, don't say that she got a bigger crowd than Beto because not everybody
well, then
there
Bernie.
Is. Oh, than Bernie. Oh, at
then
Bernie.
All,
more
than
people.
All the 2020 candidates.
Okay.
Yeah, well, more people, Libby. Will have been from Texas.
Yeah, but they're not all from Texas.
No, that's correct.
You know.
Well,
see.
The other interesting thing is, you know, few of us, I'm only slightly older than 28, haha. But, you
it's
know, few of us.
Right?
Yeah, 39, exactly. few of us have exactly the same points of view we did when we were 28, and she will evolve too as a person, and she and evolving in that particular ecosystem will be very interesting.
I got two words.
And
for
will
you.
We forgive her for it? You know, I mean, that's the question.
It's seduction.
Well, her big benefit of being in power is she's really not in. She's a freshman congresswoman, so she gets to play the underdog, even as she is the loudest voice in the Democratic Party in America right now. She gets to play the underdog. I'm fighting the system. I'm fighting my own party. And she also, her tweets, she is on negative stories about her. She tweets about them and magnifies them before people even have a chance to attack her on it. And she then gets to, on negative stories, she then debates those negative stories on her own terms. She is phenomenal on social media.
And look at us. We're all talking about her right now, which indicates the power that this woman has. But I have two words for you, and that's Ramsey Clark. Is anybody here old enough to remember Ramsey Clark,
who
was the Attorney General in the Johnson administration? And his father had been a Supreme Court judge, justice, and he was widely regarded. And then when he got out of office, he really went so far left that he became discredited among many Americans. And so that's what she has to worry about.
I have three words. You go, girl.
That's why we love Frank.
All right, let's take it. Oh, go ahead.
Okay. Roger says, seems to me that Trump's budget hands a huge cudgel to Democrats. Didn't we do that? Allowing them to criticize 45. Okay. We did that. And did we do somehow Trump and the Republicans call his tax bill a tax cut? But the Republican tax bill is a tax increase for everyone except the ultra-rich starting this year and increasing after the November 2020 election. Thank you for your conversations. That's Mary from Hinsdale, Massachusetts. Good state.
Excellent. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this. Well, Nancy Pelosi yesterday said, impeaching Donald Trump is not worth it.
She was right.
She is right.
That is what she said. So let me just read the first paragraph from she was talking to the Washington Post magazine, and she said, I'm not for impeachment. Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who has played down talk of impeachment for months, ratcheted up her objections to trying to remove President Trump from office in an interview published on Monday. Impeachment is so divisive to the country that unless there's something so compelling and overwhelming and bipartisan, I don't think we should go down that path because it divides the country. She added, and he's just not worth it. Ms. Pelosi has repeatedly made her aversion to impeachment clear in the past, but her remarks to the Post are more expansive than previous ones and are likely to irk some liberal rank-and-file members of Ms. Pelosi's party trying to build support for it.
But she'll take the heat, you see, for all of those people who don't want this impeachment. There is only one reason, in my mind, that she doesn't want the impeachment, and that is she wants to win the Senate. And, you know, they just won the House.
And she wants to win the presidency.
And they did it on Trump's back. And they're going to do it again. Right. If Trump disappears, no Trump, no Senate, no nothing.
And she knows the calculus. Talking about impeachment just riles up his base. And we don't need them to be riled up.
Yeah, it's a pragmatic and strategic thing.
Right. But it is. It's pragmatic politics, which is what you need to, which you need to have. Going into the 2020 election, we have to be incredibly pragmatic. We have to, if this isn't about just reading the tea leaves, this is about making the right decisions with the right people so we can take back the Senate and hopefully the White House.
She did couch it. She did say, unless something overwhelming happens, like
the Mueller report. And she expects that's going to happen. And I don't think she'd object to the impeachment hearings beginning, but it has to be a lot closer to the election than it is now. Now, look, she's not going to turn around and at this stage of the game and say, the reason I want him impeached, I don't want him impeached, is because I want to take the Senate and the House with even more votes than we've got now. She can't say that because then it looks like dirty old American politics. She's got to give a rationale, which she did, about riling up, you know, the base.
But I mean, it's a practical thing, too. If you know the votes are not there in the Senate to convict, it becomes just a political, you know.
Feel good.
Right, feel good thing.
I couldn't agree more. Yeah. And then the other thing I suspect is because I taught political science for a long time, most people do not know what impeachment means. Yeah. They think impeachment means you throw them out. No, it doesn't. It means you bring a charge, it goes to the Senate, and the Senate is the ones who are the ones.
And who are the only presidents impeached, political scientists?
Well, you got Andrew Johnson, right?
Of course.
And what'd you say? And Bill Clinton. And Bill Clinton.
Bill Clinton.
Well,
thank you, Mike, for giving me my opportunity to show my stuff.
Jerry Nadler, the chairman of the I believe Judiciary Committee, is still has his 81 letters out to Trump associates. They're still going to be doing panels and subpoenas.
Sure.
And Pelosi right now, I don't think, wants to leave the openness that there may be an impeachment, although I think it may put her in a precarious position if 2 years from now, let's say Donald Trump gets reelected. Are people going to say, Pelosi, you should have impeached him while you had a chance? You would have at least been able to put some wood on the ball.
So you impeach him, but then it goes to a Republican-controlled Senate. They're not going to throw him out of office. So why spend the money? Why spend the time? Why spend the political capital?
And then he'll say, I'm exonerated.
Yeah, that's right. So just spend the time fielding really good candidates.
Yeah, it was a really smart thing to do with a little bit of drama thrown in. It was perfect.
You mean what she said?
Yeah, about, you know, he's not worth it.
Yes. Yeah, but she did say he's not fit to be president. He's ethically unfit, intellectually unfit, curiosity-wise unfit, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, she still is able to say he shouldn't be there. He's the wrong guy. He doesn't deserve to be president, but this isn't the right political move.
Okay, so here's the question, which will get me into trouble, and that is, why more trouble? Why is it that a guy like Steyer, this multimillionaire, is going around and doing this, perhaps to get a little attention for himself, and going after a perfectly wonderful man like Richie Neal, my congressman from Springfield, and saying terrible things about him and getting all of his troops to write to Neil and to go and yell at Neil and do all the rest of that. You mean to say that guy Steyer doesn't know what you've just said, Mike, or Fran, or Libby? I mean, what part of this? What motivates a guy like that? You know, Schultz is running on a third party, maybe. Steyer is doing this thing. These are guys with a lot of money who like attention. That's my view.
I think it's a good analysis. Steyer obviously is trying to use his wealth and his fortune to drum up opposition to the president in the form of a campaign to have him impeached. Whether he gets him impeached, he gets all the evidence out there and all the argument out there, even if the impeachment doesn't happen, and it has the same effect. It hurts Trump.
Yeah, Mike, but he's doing damage to good people like Richie Neal, who is doing it exactly the right way. He's building a solid case. He's going to get those tax returns, but he is building a rationale for getting the tax returns. This is not good.
Doesn't it seem, though, that he'll have other enemies, too, as far as not just Richie Neal, but anyone who's imposing the idea of impeachment?
Well, I'm sorry, Joe. I didn't get the import of that.
Meaning that won't Steyer then have not just Richie Neal, but anyone who is opposing impeachment?
Oh, well, I see what you mean. He builds, you know, there will be people who will not forget this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good point.
We have a couple letters.
Oh, yes. Thank you, Joe. Tony, our friend Tony, says, AOC, it's too bad that we are rating our new politicians by how they play the game rather than who they are and what they stand for. I don't know that we're doing that, are we?
Well, does Tony say more? That's interesting.
No, that's it.
Huh.
Tony. And Tony's a great guy, and so I don't get it. It's
who plays the game the best is kind of who matters, and that's AOC and Donald Trump. Those two play the game the best. That's who matters.
Right now she's playing the game. She's playing it well, I suspect, and it doesn't appear that she's playing the game. That's what's good. You got to play the game without appearing to play the game. Do you understand the profundity of what I've just said?
I do. And also, it seems like she's having a lot of fun.
Yeah.
It really does. It seems like she's having just a blast.
When she did that little dance outside her office that time, you saw that?
Yeah.
And she did a little dance outside her office. It became international news.
Well, the opposition posted a video of her in college, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, dancing.
Dancing and saying, you know, look, this is who you have as your congresswoman. She turned it around and said, oh, yeah, well, I still dance. And then she posted that and it went nuts.
And let's not forget Emma Goldman. Yeah. If I can't dance, it's not my revolution.
So there you go. Thank you, Libby. Nice reference.
Yeah, thank you, Lib.
Ten points for Gryffindor.
That's right. There. If I can't dance, it's not my revolution.
Yeah.
And Nicholas from Westfield says, let's give AOC time to be herself and work through her term before we judge.
All right.
Agreed.
Yeah, she's got a long future ahead.
Well, let me take the con on that one. What if she says something that's really dumb, despicable,
she's
and harmful.
She's young enough to actually recover from it. I mean,
oh no, there's no question. But shouldn't she be? Shouldn't we maintain our critical ability if she does something that is really despicable?
Yeah, but critical doesn't mean she has to stop because she made a mistake.
I didn't say that. You said that.
Is there anyone in Congress who didn't make a mistake?
I didn't say that. You said it. Mike's giving me a strange look.
Really? It's like, Julia did it. No, you did it.
Julia says, Ramsey Clark and AOC. Ramsey Clark and AOC. That was then, and this is now. And that's from Jules. As you all remember, that is a famous D'Amato quote in which he was asked why he had changed his opinion. That was then, and this is now. Okay. Eric says, Nancy Pelosi, good morning, panel. In a season of great one-liners, Nancy Pelosi takes the cake with he's not worth it. I agree with that. In reference to Trump and impeachment, gotta love her. Eric from Richmond, Massachusetts. And Eric is a great theater man, and he knows about these things. Thought I'd tell you that. Pete says, Nancy Pelosi, politics versus saving democracy. Good morning, panel. Speaker Pelosi steering talk away from impeachment may be good for the 2020 elections, but how much damage to the rule of law can Trump's activities that benefit him personally and go unpunished lead to that being the norm? Manafort and Stone and Flynn end up being pardoned, let alone Trump's immediate family. I don't yet see what legal repercussions will actually take place if Trump is not reelected. And if he is, anybody got that? I don't quite get that last part. I don't yet see what, quote, legal repercussions will actually take place even if Trump is not reelected. And if he is?
Meaning if he is not reelected, what do they do with him?
Yeah.
They've lost the opportunity unless something new happens.
Yeah. Well.
Something fresh happens.
One of the things that, depending on Mueller, that may be interesting here is if he may be in, you know, we're getting a lot of mail on this, I think.
On Mueller?
No, we're getting a lot of mail on people who think that Donald Trump will not relinquish the presidency if he loses in 2020. Now, with anybody else, you'd say, oh, that's crazy. But with this guy who, you know, is facing the possibility, as I think Fran just said or whoever just said it, the possibility that when he gets out, he gets indicted and he goes to jail. So it's one of the reasons why a lot of people think he has to run in 2020, no matter what's going on.
It's to continue his immunity from prosecution.
Sure. Well, anyway, and then Nancy says anti-Semitism. Ilhan Omar, if you go back to primary sources, never said American Jews supporting Israel have dual allegiance or aren't loyal Americans. She said elected officials should not be expected to promise allegiance to a foreign government, such as to Israel, in order to serve on the Foreign Affairs Committee. I agree with her. Some didn't like her questioning of Elliot Abrams. Please watch the original source material if you're going to use your influential voice to condemn her. I have looked at it, Nancy, three or four times, and I have to tell you, I don't agree with you. I know what she meant. At least in my mind, I do.
All right. Let's see. We're going to go to a break, and then we have other stuff to talk about. And I want to talk about the Ethiopian Airlines and how that's being handled around the world. We also want to discuss women in science. Fran, are you ready?
I'm ready.
We'll talk about legislation of legalizing marijuana in New York State and the speed bumps that has hit. Alan Chartok is here, J.P. Miller, Fran Berman, Libby Post, and Mike Spain, all on your radio dial. We will continue our conversation after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Very nice to have you all here. We have a wonderful panel before us. We have Mike Spain, Libby Post, Fran Berman, J.P. Miller, Alan Chartok. A reminder that Alan will be speaking to the governor of New York State coming up at 10:30 this morning, or just right thereafter. And so that's coming up. Also, we have your letters, so we'll go there first, and then we'll move on to many other topics that we have on our docket this morning.
Okay, you want me to read these?
Yes, please.
Okay. Barbara says, today's commentary. I wish the panel would comment on Alan's belief that the Democratic primary will end up as a contest between two 75-plus-year-old white men, one progressive left of center, the other centrist. What does this say about the state of misogyny in U.S. politics when a group of talented, experienced, articulate, and younger women, also ranging in politics from centrism to progressivism, can't become front runners? And that's from Barbara. Who wants to go first? Because I'd like to answer that myself.
Well, you answer it, but we could
There's a difference between being a political scientist with what you think is going to happen. That's what I said. Put my name down, and I'm telling you right now what this is going to come down to is Bernie versus Joe in the primaries. We're already seeing it in the polls. That's called science. I couldn't agree with you more. A woman should be president of the United States.
I agree with that, but I don't think you can lead with gender. I think you got to lead with qualifications. And gender can't be a negative, but it shouldn't be the only reason you vote for people.
Well, I have great respect for you. And if you say it, it's so.
Also, the tenor of that note was about age.
Yes, and that's something I particularly resent. Don't you see?
Well,
yeah, because I'm against ageism as well as everything else.
Yeah, I'm against ageism, too.
Why is Libby laughing?
I mean, for
so
me,
hard?
Experience counts, because it's pretty clear that, you know, Washington is a very, very, very complicated place, and experience helps. Yeah.
And yet you just have very good things to say about AOC.
Yeah, I do. I have great things. I'm not suggesting she should be president right now.
But the bottom line is changing the administration. That's the bottom line here. And that we are a center-right country, so we need to find the right person who can beat Trump if he's still president at that point, or Pence if he's the president at that point, and move on and not let the perfect get in the way of the good.
I mean,
otherwise we'll have another four more years.
Realizing that I am opening up a huge can of worms by asking that question, let me just say, don't you think it is? What does the panel think? Who has, out of the two that Alan mentioned, who has the better chance of beating Trump in the fall?
Oh, I know.
Bernie
Biden.
Or Biden? Right.
Biden.
So
Biden.
Don't you think that'll figure into the calculus of Democratic voters?
Many Democratic voters. Yeah. Listen, I was for Bernie the last time, but I'm with Libby on this. And I think that this guy is such a potential totalitarian and everything else that there's got to be a different person to beat him.
I'll play devil's advocate for a minute. I do not think that the Democrats at the end of the primary are going to be choosing between two old wealthy white men. I think that they're going to have a more diverse candidate. I do not think that Joe Biden is going to make any progress in the primary. He has very little ability to raise money. He has run not once before, not twice before. He has run three times before, and none of those times was he ever even close to getting the nomination. He's a gaffe machine, and he is a reluctant warrior. He is not certain that he wants to run. All these other candidates, Elizabeth Warren, Cory Booker, these people, they want to run. They're out there. They're doing it now. Biden is a reluctant warrior. He will not be one of the finalists.
Well, that's very well put. I mean, it really is well put, and nothing you said was wrong, except that you're wrong.
Well, if it were...
nothing was wrong except everything you said.
If it is either Biden or Sanders, what do you think the likelihood of it, of their running mate not being a woman? In other words, it's extremely likely that
absolutely
each of them would pick a woman as their running mate.
Well, yes, I think Kamala Harris is the ideal.
Yeah, I think
second.
It's going to be a Biden-Harris ticket. I think that would be the dream ticket.
I don't disagree with some of the things that JP just said, but I do have to, in as far as Biden goes, I mean, the reluctance thing to me, I don't know how Alan feels about it, but it seems to me that'll go away. Once he's in, and that'll go away.
Except, Joe, Freud said, characters said it for, I think you've heard me say this
yes.
before, and JP's points, which is, I said, were all correct. He is a gaffe machine.
Oh, yes.
He does say things that get him
yeah,
into
Yeah, but he's
trouble.
A benign gaffe machine. Yeah.
I mean,
you know,
look at our current gaffe machine.
That's right.
Yeah.
In the past, those gaffes, he said something.
I mean,
know,
as long as he can get Tim
Muskie,
Apple's
or Muskie, yeah. Muskie, you're all so young, but Muskie cried in the snow.
That's right.
Those things become big stuff in a otherwise, you know.
Well, but if it's Biden, Trump,
we have a different standard of gaffes now. Yeah. I don't think they count.
I agree with you.
Right, that's the thing.
Unique, though,
and also
Trump.
The yes, he ran twice before.
Three times before.
But he also now is former vice president of the United States. Left very, very popular right. vice president. I don't know if that makes a difference.
He hasn't won any competitive. Political race in 40 years.
So,
every year he has a safe Senate seat. You need someone who can compete politically. He has shown no ability over the last 40 years to compete politically.
And Donald Trump, you remind me of his past political races?
Well,
he won the presidency.
Anything goes, I guess,
competitively.
I see, but he Trump did it without having had any background, right, JP?
I think we're in a new world. You know, I think all of the things that happened in the past, you know, what seems from this point of view to be more restrained, more polite, even though they weren't political campaigns, I think this one's just going to be really different. You know, in my class at RPI, we spent a day looking at election models and why the models didn't predict that. Most of them didn't predict that Trump would win.
Right.
And one of the reasons that a lot of the models didn't predict it is because you're just in a different land. You know, if you have a model that tells you,
TV.
You know, that it looks like, you know, all of the other elections, this wasn't an election like all of the other elections.
We had a TV star.
So, you know, now we're going to be in a really different place in this election. I think the things that were true of the old ones, they're not true anymore.
But Biden right now reminds me a lot of Jeb Bush 4 years ago. He had poll numbers. Everybody thought this is going to be the guy. Mm. And when you come in with high expectations and you have a ceiling and your poll numbers are there, it's simply, in my mind, a function of name ID. Everybody knows his name. And
I disagree, of course, okay. But I love having you on the panel.
Thanks, Alan.
No, I do. I love having you on the panel.
Everything
because,
you said is wrong, but you haven't lost your gig.
No, right. No. It's that what he said was not wrong. All of the points about Biden were correct, except I'm with Fran on this. I think at this stage of the end, Libby, I think at this stage of the game, the country needs somebody who offers a little respite from this guy who's in the White House, and that Biden is the perfect guy to do that.
I do have to say also that we were talking about AOC and bringing bigger crowds and Bernie and so forth, but you know who packed him in at South by Southwest was Elizabeth Warren, and she continues to do that wherever she goes.
Yes, that's true.
I know there is a lot of baggage there, and I know that there is a lot of consternation. However, when she goes to a rally, she's filling stadiums.
And
that is something. I think that's something to
when she came to Great Barrington.
And to JP's point, you know, she really wants it. And that counts for something.
And she's not accepting PAC money. She's not doing billionaire fundraisers. Biden cannot raise small dollar donations. He just
well,
it
let's
won't
see.
Happen.
Let's
well, that's,
see.
It's a little
let's
premature
see.
For that. And,
yeah.
you know, this notion
Tell
that he hasn't me. Won a contested race, you know, the fact of the matter is,
and he's
is that
not
he,
a candidate yet.
He was crucial to Obama's elections.
Twice
both times.
Elected vice president.
Right. He was crucial. He got the white working class vote out for him. So I respectfully disagree.
Fair.
But I love you being on the show.
Fair, so I agree, though, that the, the primary process.
Okay, all in favor that JP should stay on the show.
You haven't been voted off the island, JP.
And Nicholas writes, Steyer says that most Americans are not, in capital letters, turned into the president's tuned. It says tuned. Oh, so sorry. Tuned into the president's crimes. But as the impeachment proceedings take place, his crimes will be exposed to a wide audience and polls will shift and the American people will come to see that Trump's removal from office is necessary. to say Steyer is doing this simply because he craves attention is a bit simplistic. I personally am opposed to impeachment. What do we get if successful? Pence, Trump with a benign face. Unlike Steyer, I don't think impeachment would be successful. And that's from Nick. All right, Nick, you have a right to say that. Betsy, wait a minute. I can't disagree more, especially with Alan. Why are you disparaging liberals and people who think Steyer has a point? You're alienating people like me who want to see justice. The people will see what this administration is up to if there is impeachment. Support will rise and remove him from office. Pelosi's making a mistake. As for Representative Richard Neal, we'd like to see a few town halls hosted by him. He's largely missing from the common folks here in Western Massachusetts. Hey, I'm pretty common. I love him. And won't meet with workers, only business leaders, and won't sign on to the Green New Deal. Sincerely, Betsy. And then finally from Daniel, Senate conviction of Trump. Panel, you're basing your ideas on the Senate never convicting Trump on a current situation. Overwhelming evidence of impeachment crime should that happen, surely would change such a calculus. Daniel from New Lebanon, you could not be more right. And that's why I have said from day one, wait, and wait until you see what the special prosecutor Mueller comes up with. You're exactly right. But you don't do it prematurely. And by the way, you only get one chance. You don't say, OK, we're going to impeach him on Thursday. And, oh, the Senate did what they did with Clinton. Everybody sits around. They say no. And then you say 2 months from now, oh, we're going to try to impeach him again. Forget it. You get one shot. And that's it.
By the way, Alan, when do you think the Mueller report is coming out? I mean, what's the holdup? Everybody keeps saying close.
I think nobody knows.
No,
it'll be ready when it's ready and when he's ready.
Nobody knows.
There's reporters at the Justice Department every morning, and it's an increasing number. So at least the anticipation is that it'll be very soon.
I was interested to find out, though, that when you look at special prosecutors, that these types of reports, this actually is not a long one yet. As far as the investigation goes. I mean, and as far as timelines go, the Ken Starr investigation went way longer than this one did.
And so it cost a whole lot more.
Right. Yeah. So we're all waiting, obviously, but as far as the time that it takes to do these investigations, it is a relatively short period of time, although, you know, tick-tock.
Well, everybody's just so
hungry.
They just want it already because they think it's going to be an immediate, he's going to be out of office, and that's not going to be true. But let's not forget, you know, Nixon was not impeached and he ended up resigning because of all the bad press. And
he resigned because he saw that his political
race
in Congress was gone and he would be impeached.
That's right. Yeah. And so, and I think after the report comes out, maybe a little bit of his base will go, but I think the political support of Congress, which is already starting to erode, will erode even further.
All right. Let's go to a couple of stories before we say goodnight. One is
Gracie.
Goodnight, Gracie. One is the Ethiopian Airlines crash. We are hearing new news now that, Britain, Mike, that
Britain's
has added
the latest, Australia earlier today, Singapore jumped in. I mean, more and more countries are banning this variety of 737s. The U.S. is standing by Boeing and saying that they're safe to take.
Two major airlines, American Airlines and Southwest Airlines, which are heavy users of the MAX 8, continue to fly them on Monday. This version of the Boeing popular jet is under intensified scrutiny after the deadly crash of Ethiopian Airlines Flight 302 on Sunday. 17 leading the carrier and at least 17 others around the world to ground their 737 MAX 8 planes. The FAA in the United States, in a continued airworthiness notification, said that the investigation had just begun and that it did not have information to draw any conclusions or take any action, meaning the agency still considered the MAX 8 safe to fly, but pilots and flight attendants in the U.S. raised questions about the MAX 8 safety. If my pilot and flight attendant are worried, I don't know that I want to get on that
plane. Well, exactly. I was wondering, has anybody bothered? Have you seen any journalism where pilots have spoken up about this? Because I always feel good on a plane saying, okay, I don't like being on a plane. Planes can crash and all the rest of this stuff. But as long as there's a pilot sitting up there whose life is on the line, you know, I feel pretty good about this. But I'd like to know what the pilots are thinking about
this. Did anyone hear the interview with a former FAA official this morning after the 8 o'clock hour on NPR? He was basically saying that I would fly a 737 MAX. But I wouldn't want my family to fly on
it. Well,
yeah, I heard that. That was
I don't know what kind of an endorsement that was. Hmm.
I mean, one thinks that from the airline's point of view, they're trying to figure out which is the worst of the options, right? So you don't really have the data that says what's exactly wrong. People think perhaps, but we don't have the data yet that that there's a problem with the software system and with the training of pilots, and that led to those things. But you don't really have all the data, so you don't really know. And you're an airline, and you're trying to figure out, do you pull all of these planes because of sort of popular opinion about that, because people are worried, and your flight attendants are worried, and your pilots are worried? Or, you know, I mean, because there's business repercussions to that, or do you, you know, let all your customers get really upset and not want to take those planes? I mean, those are hard decisions for businesses to make.
And there are tens of thousands of these flights going on
every day. So, you know, those are really hard decisions. And in a sense, you know, from a purely scientific point of view, it's sort of prudent to wait for the data. On the other hand, from an emotional point of view, you don't want to take that plane.
Well, it may be prudent for you, but it's not prudent for me.
I mean, the number of 737 MAX 8s in the fleet of Southwest, 34 planes, 24 for American Airlines, 24 for Air Canada, all three are still in flight and not have been grounded
yet. And Southwest both service the Albany County
Airport. Well, I'm looking at
Albany International Airport.
I'm flying on Southwest in a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
And it's a 737-700, which is different.
Yeah, there's a lot of 737s. The MAX is
those are
for more long distance flights. So it's unlikely that they would come in and out of Albany, but they would fly from like their hubs in Baltimore or Chicago, you know, cross country. Or down to Mexico or the Caribbean.
But it doesn't take much for something to get a bad, you know, a bad rap.
Yeah.
I mean, again, this is an aged reference, but, you know, we all just assumed if we were driving in a Pinto and we got rear-ended, we were going to blow up.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Now, that only happened, what, two or three times, actually.
Right.
And yet we were pretty sure. That was
or how about Tylenol?
Exactly.
Right.
Well, Tylenol is a perfect example. They immediately took everything off the shelves and repackaged everything.
That's the tough thing about Boeing. Boeing right now, over the last 10 days, has lost 10% of their market capitalization of the company. The value of the company is down 10%. It's down 5% today. They're going to continue. I think until they pull the planes, they're going to continue to be in trouble.
And it's the number one stock on the U.S. stock market. Yeah. In other words, the most appreciation, I believe, of any stock.
Well, they have 4,000 orders outstanding for these planes, 5,000.
Yeah. Yeah.
So just to refresh you all, I kind of got geeky about this when I was thinking about it, and I was thinking, okay, what about the data? How do you get the data? How do you withstand, you know, losing the data in a plane crash? And so I was, you know, trying to find a little information about these flight data recorders and cockpit voice recorders. The flight data recorders, some of that data is replicated, you know, in the control tower and all stuff like that, but not the cockpit voice recorder. And
they found it though, didn't they?
They've engineered these things like crazy. You know, it has to withstand over 1,000 degrees heat. Well, actually, over 1,300 Fahrenheit. It has to require. Withstand, you know, these really, really catastrophic crashes. And so it's amazing. However, if these things are burnt, so this is what they don't know now, you know, if there's smoke damage or if the data gets contaminated in some way because of the crash, then it's harder to read it. So that's what they're trying to figure out now.
I always love it when you see that. No, I don't love it. I'm sorry. I take that back. When you see the pictures of the crash site, you see hundreds of people milling around looking at the ground. It's always very interesting that what are they doing? I mean, what exactly are they looking for?
Yeah, the recovery teams have a grim job. They're picking up personal artifacts and collecting them and trying to sort them to get them back to the families. And then, of course, there's the recovery of the deceased after a crash like that, which must be a very difficult task.
Well said.
All right, we have we're out of time. My apologies.
What happened to Fran? Wasn't Fran going to talk to us?
That's all right. I'm sorry, but we're out of time. We have to get. We have time for the governor, so we have to make time for that.
Yeah.
Good. Thank you all very much. Very nice to have you here
Great
this morning.
Panel.
Thank you very much. And when we're going to take a break, and when we come back, Alan will be with the governor of New York State, Andrew Cuomo, versus.